You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of April, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears, who talks holidays, happiness, and health tourism.
The government is involved in this drive. They're part of this medical tourism board. If you go onto the website, it looks like a holiday website, and it's tacking on all these things of, oh, hey, if you come here for treatment, you can have this beautiful beachside holiday. We make it very easy for you. Look how nice KL is. So it's really an experience.
Also on the show, the developmental race. 170 years ago, two men worked out the same thing at virtually the same time. But who really invented the photograph first?
It's a tough question, and a lot of people will give you a straightforward opinion. I like the idea that photography wasn't invented by one person, that it was a dual effort in a way, coming from two different directions.
Plus, the politics of religion and rebellion. We take a look at the Middle East and ask, where are the secular rebels?
Also, in our preview of this week's Section D, we're talking to the people who've made a business out of connecting craftsmen.
People are looking for this level of work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a classic proposition when someone has incredible work and someone's trying to find them, but they can't. So if you provide an outlet for that, we've seen the success in a relatively short amount of time in 2 years.
All that, plus we'll be talking to our good friend Adam Labor in Budapest. We'll play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
And that is all coming up in the next 58 minutes here on Midori House. But as ever, we'll start with the news headlines. Here's Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The US Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, has urged North Korea to take the path of peace. He was speaking as he welcomed his Japanese counterpart to the Pentagon. Their meeting came amid a diplomatic standoff between Pyongyang and Washington over the North's nuclear programs. Tensions between North Korea and South Korea and its ally, the United States, have risen in recent weeks since the UN tightened sanctions following North Korea's third nuclear weapon test in February. But Mr. Hagel says they are prepared to deal with the North.
Our capabilities with our allies in the region to deal with provocations, as we have said before, is one that gives us a strong set of preparations, which, as I have already noted, we are prepared for any contingency.
The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met a group of senior Arab officials in Washington on Monday in his continuing efforts to build regional support for any fresh push for Israeli-Palestinian peace. He met ministers and officials from six Arab states, as well as officials from the Palestinian Authority and the Arab League. After their meeting, Mr. Kerry and the Arab states voiced support for a 2002 Arab League peace initiative.
On behalf of the president, I reaffirmed, as did the vice president, the U.S. commitment to pursue an end to the conflict based on the vision that President Obama outlined in May of 2011, two states living side by side in peace and security, brought about through direct negotiations between the parties.
A Mississippi martial arts instructor has appeared in federal court to face charges in connection with mailing letters containing the deadly poison ricin to President Obama and other U.S. officials. Everett Dutschke was arrested on Saturday in Tupelo, Mississippi, after authorities searched his former business and home. He's charged with developing and possessing ricin and attempting to use it as a weapon. He denies any involvement with the ricin letters. According to court records, he also faces charges in a separate case for fondling three children. Cyprus's parliament will decide on Tuesday whether to back a bailout imposed by its EU partners, with approval likely from a thin majority against mounting calls for the island to exit the euro. Lawmakers are due to meet in an extraordinary session at 4 p.m. local time to ratify the terms of the aid. It's conditional on Cyprus winding down its second largest bank and imposing heavy losses on uninsured depositors in another. Support's been pouring in for Jason Collins, a 32-year-old NBA player who on Monday became the first active player in a major men's North American team sport to announce that he's gay. There have been many tributes from sport and entertainment figures, but they've also come from the former president, Bill Clinton, and the First Lady, Michelle Obama. White House spokesman Jay Carney said Collins' announcement was a major milestone.
Here at the White House, you know, we view that as another example of the progress that has been made and the evolution that has been taking place in this country, and commend him for his courage and support him in his in this effort, and hope that his fans and his team support him going forward.
The governor of Tokyo has apologised for remarks he made about Istanbul, one of its rivals in the bidding contest to host the 2020 Olympics. In an interview with the New York Times, Naoki Inoue said the only thing Islamic countries have in common is Allah. They are fighting with each other and they have classes. He's now admitted that his remarks were inappropriate. Tokyo and Istanbul are competing with Madrid to host the 2020 Games. Tokyo hosted the 1964 Olympics. The other two cities have never staged the Games. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back in about 25 minutes with another check of the world headlines. It's a tough competition, those Summer Olympics, deciding who gets to be the host city.
That's why you're not making the decision.
Who do you think will come away? Moving on, who do you think will come away in for 2020? I think Istanbul's got a pretty good chance.
I would like to see it go to Istanbul. I have to say, I feel like it's a you know we've talked a lot about the emergingness of Turkey, and I think it would be a great step for them to take on the mantle of such a massive task.
I've got to put in a bit of a plug here.
Go on.
Next week on May 7th and 8th, Tyler, our editor-in-chief, Tyler Boulay, and Andrew Tucker, editor, will be in Istanbul for two very special editions of The Globalist.
Hey,
and,
nice seg.
And we will be speaking to the head of Istanbul's 2020 Olympic bid. So I'm sure we'll get some good insights from that.
So you're definitely believing that Istanbul is
I'm
the place for it.
You're able to get a couple tickets to the opening ceremony.
I'm going to go into that interview saying, I kind of fancy Madrid, actually.
Yeah. It is 10:07 in Istanbul. It's 8:07 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And you are listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's 15:07 in Hong Kong. And yes, it is 8:07 in London. It's time now to get ready and set the day's agenda, choosing the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours.
Indeed, we caught up with our Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears, just before we went on air and asked her what her big topics were. And it turns out the first one, the one at the very top of her news podium, Golden Week.
Golden Week is something we've talked about a little bit on the Hong Kong Agenda Centre before. It's this week of holidays, which kind of is anchored around tomorrow, May Day, obviously quite a big holiday in China and here in Hong Kong. It's a week when a lot of mainland tourists come to Hong Kong and a lot of money spent in both hotels and in shops. But it seems that the numbers aren't looking so good this week. It's about 15% down on tour groups. About 270 tours have arrived in the city so far, and 900 more are expected, but that's still not as much as last year. The stores here and the hotels here are wondering if they'll be turning as many profits as they expected to.
Okay, a bit of nail biting behind the counters then. Any indication as to why the graph is going a little bit downhill this year?
From people who have been spoken to, the mainland tourists who are here already, they're saying that why should they be paying the extortionate hotel prices of this week, which is, you know, when everyone whacks up their prices, because they're seeing such high demand, they'd rather come back and shop in Hong Kong at another time. These tourists come to shop in Hong Kong because it's cheaper to buy luxury goods here than it is in the mainland. They even come and buy things like luxury flats, but people are clocking on to the fact that they can do that any time of the year. They don't have to come during this busy, expensive period. Apparently, the number of individual tourists are up. There's about 10-12% increase on those who are coming without the tour groups. But it's thought that those who come as individuals aren't going to spend as much as the tour groups because they're on more of a budget.
And outside of Golden Week, has this trend been happening month by month for across, you know, the last 12 months or so, this downward decline in tourist spending?
No, I think, I mean, there's still a lot of spending going on from the mainland. It's just interesting seeing that the two golden weeks each year, that these aren't as popular as perhaps they were, and perhaps because the spending is up throughout the rest of the year and people are realizing that it's much easier for them to come on the odd weekend or even do a day trip if they live close to Hong Kong rather than invest in a kind of week-long tour during an expensive time.
And presumably the hotel sector isn't considering a response to this mainland Chinese outrage at the hotel prices by, say, trying to encourage them in with a bit of clever price strategy.
Apparently they have. So a few hotels have been reducing their rates this year by about 10%. So people are cutting their rates and it's about 80% occupancy, which is about the same as it was looking to be this week. 80% occupancy was about the same as last year. But clearly the hotels are realizing that if they put the rates down a little bit more, they'll get these big tour groups who will come in and spend for them and the other businesses nearby.
And another story that you've mentioned, Aisha, medical tourism is big business, especially in Southeast Asia. And it looks like Malaysia is now really hoping to gather a bit more of that momentum.
Indeed. So a couple of days ago, the Malaysia Healthcare Travel Council opened a concierge and lounge at the Kuala Lumpur International Airport, which seems like quite a weird thing to do. So it's located at two places in KL International Airport. There's Gate 5 and Gate 8 for those listening in case you're going to be passing through KL. The lounge is for people who are on their way to Malaysia for medical treatment, to relax, to kind of meet with anybody they need to meet with. And the concierge is there to provide information. So not only will it provide information as to where the best places are for you to go and get your treatment, it can also make appointments for you. The council is saying that it's aimed not just at tourists, it's also aimed at locals, at Malays who might be coming back into KL. It's in a huge part of Malaysia's economy. There's more than 300,000 more healthcare tourists came last year to Malaysia than they did in 2010. And it amounts to, they're hoping this year it'll amount to about 158 million euros worth of business.
That's clearly very sizable, and the fact that they're sort of building some sort of service-based kind of infrastructure around it, I guess, is an indicator. But I wonder where are the majority of these patients coming from if they're not from Malaysia itself.
A lot of people are coming from the UK. I think, you know, Malaysia is a post-Commonwealth state, obviously likes to attract people from the UK. It's much easier for people from the UK and the Commonwealth to get access to Malaysia in terms of visa stuff. About 8.5% of all UK medical tourists are going to Malaysia for medical treatment. And it's interesting to see how it's sold. The government is involved in this drive. They're part of this medical tourism board. If you go onto the website, it looks like a holiday website, and it's tacking on all these things of, oh, hey, if you come here for treatment, you can have this beautiful beachside holiday. We make it very easy for you. Look how nice KL is. So it's really an experience. It kind of reduces the fear, I think, a lot of people find with medical treatment. It's obviously a lot more affordable than having medical treatment across Europe and in the US. And so now people are turning it into this lifestyle option. You've also got Indonesia, who are trying to make themselves the spa destination of Southeast Asia. So tacking on a little bit of health to your holiday as opposed to making it just a quite dry medical treatment experience.
And the numbers really are quite startling. I think the latest figures have about 1 million tourists from overseas coming to Malaysia to get these medical treatments done. Do we know if Malaysia is linking up with any hospitals or clinics internationally, whether it is UK-based hospitals or hospitals in America? And are they also, can you give us a sense of what the most popular treatments are, of what's actually being done to these people?
I think it's a range of everything from a normal checkup to quite intense surgery. When I've been in Malaysia, there have been times when I've gone and you can just walk into a hospital, you book an appointment like you would if you were going to have a haircut or something. In you go, you have your checkup, you have your blood test, and out you go, you leave a check. So I think there are people who might be going there thinking they want a holiday, don't want to pay the expensive prices that they're paying where they live, and just adding that on to their holiday experience. It seems quite strange to add a health checkup to your holiday experience, but clearly Malaysia's doing quite well out of that.
Aisha, can we talk about happiness? I want some good news about happiness. What sort of good news about happiness have you got?
Sadly, I haven't got very good news about happiness when it comes to just talking about Hong Kong. I know it doesn't sound very good. Despite me thinking that actually the quality of life here in Hong Kong is somewhat better than in New York, at least from what I have experienced over the last few weeks, a recent survey conducted by the Shui Yan University, who conducts an annual survey on Hong Kong residents' happiness, they call up 1,000 people. So it's not a huge survey, but it's significant enough. They're saying that there's been a drop in the number of people who have said that they were were happy with their lives. It was at 79% this year, and it was 83% last year. And the people they've seen the biggest drop from are those who they say are living within the sandwich class, those whose incomes exclude them from government help, but they also don't earn enough to really be, you know, comfortable themselves.
That is indeed sad news, but perhaps some people from Hong Kong should head up to Bhutan, which I understand is always ranked as the happiest place on earth.
That's a very specific piece of information from you. Yes, Phil.
Some good advice.
It does. We talked about that last week, I believe, on Midori House. Aisha, before you go, what sort of factors play a part in Hong Kongers' happiness? What are the things that might make them happier and get it back to 83%?
The people who were surveyed said that rent is perhaps, you know, rent is really a big issue. So when they proposed the idea of a government subsidized home ownership scheme, that a lot of people said that would make them happy. Other people also said they'd like increase in the number of public holidays, although there are 18 public holidays a year here, which is really, in my mind, quite excessive. So I don't know how many more they would like. And they also said that they would like the government to do a replay of what they did a few years ago, where they just gave everybody in Hong Kong who's had a Hong Kong ID 6,000 Hong Kong dollars, and apparently that was just because the government had too much money and didn't know where else to spend it.
And that was our Hong Kong Bureau Chief Aisha Spears there, setting the day's news agenda from Asia. I'm feeling pretty happy here in the UK.
There we go. High happiness rating for the 1,001th person we asked.
Yeah, I think I've got about an 87% happiness
rocketing
index.
Into the 80s, huh?
Yeah.
Wow. I suddenly feel bad that I'm hovering around 85 today.
We'll change that.
Overall, we are doing well. I'll be in the 90s by the end of the show.
Excellent.
And we're heading to the Middle East next. After this short break, we're going to be talking about where the secular rebels have gone.
The May issue of Monocle turns its attention to the world of design, with a directory of all the things you need to build a better home. But we also get out our tape measure to size up how design can save a city, revive an island economy, put the life back into a faded business, and help a media brand rise above its rivals. But there's so much more this month.
In the design section, we profile the reclusive centenarian architect responsible for Milan's modernist moments, Luigi Cacciadominioni. Our spring design directory brings you the products, shops and collaborators to reboot your apartment, house or retreat. And for this month's expo, I headed to Fogo Island off the Newfoundland coast to see how one woman's work is bringing this frozen hunk of rock in from the cold.
In the edit section, we hop on a plane that takes us from Midori House down to Patagonia, where we visit Puerto Varas, a cozy lakeside town that's flourishing with artisanal shops and attracting foreigners seeking to refurbish old fincas. We also take a peek inside the factory of Olympia, a coffee machine maker in Switzerland, just before we tour Taipei's shopping district to fill our bags with everything from stationery to custom-made bikes.
The May issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how to get on board.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. When the Arab Spring erupted across the Middle East more than 2 years ago, it was heralded as a moment that democracy took over from leaders that have long governed with an iron fist. But as instability continued in the region, more radical elements of political parties began to take shape and gain popular support. In Egypt, it was the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood that won elections.
Now many analysts are beginning to look at the continuing situation in Syria as a case that once marginal or centrist groups are becoming radicalised. After 2 years of fighting and more than 70,000 people dead, some, including the New York Times this weekend, believes that there is no secular fighting force to speak of in the country. So what's happened to secular rebels in the region, and how much more power have the Islamists claimed? Well, to share his view with us on the line is the Foreign Policy Forum EA World Views editor, Scott Lucas, a regular on Monocle. Welcome back to Midori House, Scott. Should we start with that New York Times article then? It's created a lot of waves, suggesting that essentially secular rebels don't exist anymore. Do you agree?
No. It's a terrible article. It's based on almost no research from the ground. It lifts a soundbite from one very good analyst from the Institute of Study of War, but rips it out of context to claim there are no secular rebels. No analyst of any value on Syria would say it is only Islamists who are fighting the Assad regime. That's not to say that there aren't some very significant Islamist factions that are involved, such as Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, but the point is that the insurgency is made up of a range of elements. There are former protesters who were involved in 2011 in Aleppo, in Hama and Homs in Damascus, who have basically turned to fighting because they were met by force from the regime. There are other secular activists who continue to be involved in pressing the case that something needs to be done politically. There are a lot of activists who we need to recognize who advocate nonviolence, who are outside the framework of the fighting that we talk about. The Free Syrian Army, which is a coalition of fighting groups, is not a single command structure, but it does include a number of brigades in which, you know, the fighters are actually advocating, as it were. They're not pursuing Sharia law. They're not pursuing Islamism. They are looking for change and the overthrow of the Assad regime, but on secular lines. Now, a good piece would go into this, and it would take many, many column inches, not the few column inches that the New York Times put out basically as reader bait and to create a sensational story that doesn't exist.
Well, let's look at that one group that you mentioned, the al-Nusra Front. They are affiliated with, or at least aligned with al-Qaeda, but they are a very effective fighting force in Syria. They're extremely well-equipped, they're determined, and many are saying in parts of Aleppo and Homs, for example, that they're the force that are really fighting the Assad regime.
Well, right there, with respect, you've just illustrated how a story gets distorted. The al-Nusra Front are not affiliated with al-Qaeda. That is based on a horrible, horrible misinterpretation of a statement a few weeks ago by some mainstream outlets. The al-Nusra Front actually said, we are an autonomous fighting force. We are Islamist. We are fighting for Syrians. They did not say at any point they're aligned with al-Qaeda. But that myth has spread. What is more important than that myth is that al-Nusra, which is a relatively small part of the insurgency, in the areas where it has fought, however, it has fought effectively, and in some villages and towns, it has taken basically the political leadership to try to basically reorganize services, establish local government. So they are Islamist. They are not affiliated with al-Qaeda. They will be part of a post-Assad Syria. And rather than just stigmatizing this, and rather than just saying you're for or against Islamist, you have to basically deal with the political complexities when they occur.
Scott, then, as you see it, you've sort of alluded to a couple of points already where it seems that the media's interaction with the issues at work in Syria have tended to oversimplify things, or at least put a slant on them that you see as slightly more complicated. How much of a factor is the media's treatment of what's going on in Syria to the way that powers around the world are then thinking of acting?
Well, initially, I don't think it is, because, for example, the internal evaluations of the British government, and indeed I think of the U.S. government, are not that al-Nusra and other groups are affiliated with al-Qaeda. They're too sensible for that. They are worried, however, at what they see as extremism in the insurgency. So they're trying to support moderate groups. And what happens is that while the media stories may not have effect the first time they come out, if you keep repeating this false narrative, then the policymakers may think, well, perhaps we're missing something here. And you buy into a situation where instead of making rational policy choices, you do it on the basis of myth.
And Scott, over the weekend, Senator John McCain, he's on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the Republican senator, he came out saying that the West and America should consider putting troops on the ground in Syria. That option does not look like it's going to be likely anytime soon. Do you think the United States and the West have missed an opportunity here with Syria? And do you think the West and the Americans have any part to play in perhaps the radicalization of these rebel forces?
I think they missed a big opportunity last year, which contributed to, you know, a fragmentation situation. I think there should have been attention paid to establishing a no-fly zone or a protected zone in parts of Syria that were held by the insurgents. The U.S., Britain, Arab states were indecisive, and that meant that rather than building from this protected zone, as it were, an alternative space for Syrians to be able to live peacefully, you had an explosion. That's a bad word, actually. You had an extension of fighting groups, because as the conflict gets more and more violent, as the regime uses more and more bigger weapons indiscriminately against civilians, you get more insurgents that come out of that. And so here we are now a year later. I'm not sure we can go back and establish a protected zone. I would like to hope it could be done. But I think the reality is that the choice for the U.S., Britain, and other states is simply whether you're going to give more arms, not troops on the ground, but more arms to the insurgents to finally take Assad out once and for all.
Scott, you've explained how you disagree with that sort of baiting article, as you described it, from the New York Times about the fact that secular rebels don't exist anymore. We've been focusing on Syria. Could you broaden it out for us? Tell us about that question in other countries in the region.
Yeah, I think sometimes the dangers where we get is all of a sudden you talk about radicalization or radical Islamist, and we're not sure what we mean here. Look at Tunisia, which was the first country in the Arab Spring to replace, authoritarian government. It is led by an Islamist group, if you want to use a label, a moderate Islamist group called Ennahda, but they're in coalition with secular parties, so it's not completely run by Islamists. If you look at a case such as Libya, Libya has a government which is not really Islamist. It, again, is a coalition of groups, many of whom do not pursue a religious agenda. And if you look at Egypt, even though you talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, as it were, being linked to President Morsi, it's not really pursuing an Islamist agenda in bringing in sweeping Sharia law. There's a major debate going on right now over the Constitution. There's a major debate going over Parliament. And most importantly, the key issue in Egypt is not Islamization. It's who's going to run the economy effectively.
Scott Lucas from EA Worldview, thanks so much, as ever, for joining us here on Midori House. It's 8 a.m. here in London. Now, the history of photography is already over 170 years old, but not too many people know that the technique to capture images was actually invented separately by two men. Even though the Frenchman Louis Daguerre and the British man Henry Fox Talbot had never met, they both invented rudimentary photographic methods in the same period.
But the big question still remains, which one of the inventors got there first? Well, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke with Roger Watson, co-author of Capturing the Light, a true story of genius, rivalry, and the birth of photography, who gave us a fascinating insight on the topic.
The topic is the double birth of photography. Photography had two inventors in two countries at the same time. And it's a little bit of a story looking at the two men themselves and what their lives were like and what led them to inventing photography.
It's fascinating. For what I've been reading, they have very different personalities as well. So let's start maybe with the British guy, Henry Fox Talbot.
Yes, Henry Talbot is he is the quiet, shy, introverted genius who spends a lot of time in his study thinking deep thoughts and coming up with ideas, and photography was one of those. He was a member of the landed gentry, so he had his foot in several different worlds. He was also a member of Parliament.
So let's cross to the more flamboyant one,
yes.
Louis Daguerre.
Louis Daguerre is as opposite to Talbot as you can get. He is a flamboyant, extroverted showman, businessman, entrepreneur. He is Parisian through and through, although he's actually born outside of Paris. But yes, he was the epitome of the outgoing showman of the time.
I believe they never met, right?
They didn't, and it's almost shocking that they didn't, because they did have some friends in common. And Talbot certainly was passing through Paris a number of times, and Daguerre did make a couple of trips to London, but they never actually met.
Who got there first?
Yeah, that's...
I mean, I had to ask that.
I know, it's a tough question, and a lot of people will give you a straightforward opinion. I like the idea that photography wasn't invented by one person, that it was a dual effort in a way, coming from two different directions. It's not unusual in science for two people to come up with an idea at the same time.
And how come in the same year?
That's the tricky business. Daguerre actually got started in the 1820s experimenting, but didn't come to a solution until 1837, so it took him quite a while. Talbot began in 1833, 1834, and by 1836 he had a process, but he simply put it in his desk drawer and moved on to other projects. So he could have announced a couple of years earlier than he did, but he didn't.
Did they use different methods?
Again, the methods really reflect the man themselves. Daguerre was a painter, and he was interested in the one-off piece of art, the shining example of uniqueness. And his daguerreotype process was just that. It was a one-off process. There was no negative, so you couldn't make more than one print. And the image itself was actually on a plate of silver. Whereas Talbot's process, Talbot came from a background where he was used to publishing. So he was looking at things on paper, he was looking at reproducibility, and he was the one who came up with the idea of creating first a negative, and then from that you could make as many positives as you wanted to.
In your opinion, who was the most influential?
Ooh, in the first 10 years or so after the announcement, Daguerre was definitely the most influential. Everybody in the world wanted to have a daguerreotype made. It was the thing to do. And as a matter of fact, the only five portraits of Talbot before 1860 are all daguerreotypes. So even he had his daguerreotype made. But in the end, the idea of reproducibility really won out. And pretty much from the 1850s through to the digital age, we were looking at the negative-positive process.
I want to ask as well, because you're involved with the Musée Daguerre, can you tell us a little bit more about this project?
It's a brand new museum. We have the Fox Talbot Museum in Laycock, which is where I work, and Paris had never had a museum specifically for Daguerre. Well, the village of Brie-sur-Marne, where he lived after retirement, have bought his house, and they're converting it to they're not sure yet if it's going to be the Musée Daguerre or the Maison Daguerre, but it's going to be a museum to Daguerre and workshop space as well for encouraging people to experiment with photography.
Great that you're working with both of them.
So. I love it. Well, we're trying to say these two men were great men and they both invented photography, and we're not going to fight about it. We're going to both celebrate it.
Roger Watson and Fernando Augusto Pacheco there. Roger's book, Capturing the Light, a true story of genius rivalry and the birth of photography, is, I imagine, out now or out soon. The time is 15:31 in Singapore, 8:31 a.m. here in London. You're listening to Midori House.
In the next half hour of the programme, we find out what stories are making the headlines in Hungary. We'll see how the Italian press are reacting to the new coalition government, and we'll discover an online retail venture that's beginning to turn heads globally.
People are looking for this level of work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a classic proposition when someone has incredible work and someone's trying to find them, but they can't. So if you provide an outlet for that, we've seen this success in a relatively short amount of time in 2 years.
So a very busy second half of the program. But before all that, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. The US Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel has urged North Korea to take the path of peace. He was speaking as he welcomed his Japanese counterpart to the Pentagon amid a diplomatic standoff between Pyongyang and Washington over the North's nuclear programs. Secretary of State John Kerry met a group of senior Arab officials in Washington on Monday in his continuing efforts to build regional support for any fresh push for Israeli-Palestinian peace. After their meeting, all parties voiced support for a 2002 Arab League peace initiative. A Mississippi martial arts instructor has appeared in federal court facing charges in connection with mailing letters containing the deadly poison ricin to President Obama and other U.S. officials. Everett Dutschke denies any involvement with the ricin letters. According to court records, he also faces charges in a separate case for fondling three children. Cyprus's parliament will decide later today whether to back a bailout imposed by its EU partners, with approval likely from a thin majority against mounting calls for the island to exit the euro. Support's been pouring in for Jason Collins, the 32-year-old basketball player who on Monday became the first active player in a major men's North American team sport to announce that he's gay. There have been many tributes from sport and entertainment figures, but they've also come from the former President Bill Clinton and the First Lady Michelle Obama. The governor of Tokyo has apologised for remarks he made about Istanbul, one of its rivals in the bidding contest to host the 2020 Olympics. Naoki Inoue says remarks he made in the New York Times about Islamic countries were inappropriate. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Now, on today's preview of Section D, we find out about Bespoke Global. It is a 2-year-old online retail venture that's beginning to turn heads.
As you might expect from its name, it deals with craftsmen and artists rather than large-scale manufacturing. And connecting the world's craftsmen and women to each other and to new customers too is proving a pretty successful venture. Bespoke Global's founders Pippa McArdle and Gwen Carlton are both from New York, and they spoke to our own Hugo McDonald.
Bespoke Global really is a, we consider, premier destination for artisan designers who specialize in custom and made-to-order work across sort of luxury products within, you know, lifestyle and also home. Really authentic artisans really specialize in certain techniques from all over the world.
You're both from New York. Did it start in New York and with artisans and craftsmen in New York and has sort of expanded out from there?
Absolutely. I mean, Gwen really can probably tell the story a little bit better than I can about... She's an incredible artist, so...
We did start in New York, but we really... Even at our first launch, we had artists from all over the world. For the most part, people that I'd known for the last 10 or so years, making bespoke lighting. So just artists whose work I really admired, that I'd worked on projects with, who I managed to get to say yes.
That's very important, I imagine.
Yeah, in the beginning, that was very important.
Why do you think the need for a digital platform to showcase this work...
Well, the design industry, as you know, is a little bit sort of slow to move into sort of change. And I think the internet is an incredible place to really provide sort of empowerment to the sort of general consumer. And traditionally, these artists and designers are really kept apart. And they're kept apart not only by their geography, but also contractually. They're actually not allowed to actually be together in one place because of contractual reasons, the showrooms and so forth that represent them. So I think it's kind of amusing to think that in this day and age that the best of the best cannot be put together in one place. So, you know, people are looking for this level of work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a classic proposition when someone has incredible work and someone's trying to find them, but they can't. So if you provide an outlet for that or a forum for that, you know, we've seen this success in a relatively short amount of time in 2 years really explode because these clients are all over the world, Russia, Australia, all through the UK. You know, we haven't done any print or online advertising. So this is people really searching for the work and hearing about it, reading about us in newspapers or hearing us on the radio. So thank you so much for having us and really connecting with the work.
You mentioned clients there, and I'm interested, what sort of clients do you have and how do people find you? You mentioned there that it tends to be word of mouth, but are these architects, interior designers, are they just curious people who want to buy into something that they know has been handcrafted and has a story behind it and isn't going to be found in the shelves of Walmart down the road?
I think, you know, primarily we solve problems. We're a service company. So people who are looking for incredible work that solves a problem, custom and made to order, normally is because it needs to fit somewhere or it needs to be made for a client. So it's either, you know, general consumers who want a certain piece that they want a certain way, or architects, interior designers, private jets, and also yachts.
I'm assuming they're not hanging a chandelier in a private jet.
Why? Why would you assume that?
What is the range, though, of the things that you have? I mean, you mentioned, Gwen, you obviously come from an artist background.
Sure. We are all categories across home. So everything from lighting to case goods to beds to you name it. And then we recently launched our leisure collection, which is sporting and gaming, which is a tremendous amount of fun if you haven't taken a look. So, and that's everything from leather falcon hoods to fly fishing rods and reels to really stunning wooden kayaks and canoes by Nick Shada, who also happens to be in the permanent collection of MoMA as well as on our website. So,
and how do you, I mean, you mentioned also that the tides turn slightly. Instead of you going to people now come to you. How many craftsmen do you represent?
We currently have 75 artists on the actual website, but we have around 300 in due diligence right now. How we sort of select the artists and designers is we look at their body of work, we look at their clients, we look at their production techniques. You know, we're very, very thorough. So not everyone
makes
the grade.
No, good, because obviously quality is key to keeping the service that you offer at that level, that people trust what you do and come back or tell their friends about it too.
Absolutely. And, you know, the leisure collection came around because our clients were coming to us and saying, thank you so much. You know, I enjoyed working with you. Do you know anyone who does backgammon boards? I want to get a present for my wife, or I really love fly fishing, but I want something super custom. And do you know who does that? So, you know, we were naturally sourcing things for our clients that were outside our scope of work, right? It's really a part of our service component going above and beyond for our clients. So we amassed this kind of incredible collection just by servicing our clients that Gwen and I thought, well, there's obviously a need for this. We don't even represent this, and people are coming to us. So that's why we launched the leisure and sporting, because our clients, you know, have passions. They're connoisseurs.
And they know what they want.
They know what they want. Mm. But also, they sort of want to sort of be a part of the experience of creating something and having a story to tell, you know, social currency, so to speak. So I think that's definitely an area that we've seen growing as well, which is interesting.
And to take it back to the artists and the craftsmen and the makers that you represent, I mean, they must love the fact that now they have a new avenue on which to, or a platform on which to get their work, the recognition that their work maybe hasn't had in the past.
Absolutely. I think the founder of the company, Gwen, coming from that background, sort of sets the tone for the company. I think we look at things very differently. I think we've structured the business very differently. We're very artist-centric and service-oriented towards our clients. So really, these artists and designers, I mean, they're passionate about creating best-in-class work. They do not compromise. But they're not particularly interested in having an e-commerce site or marketing. They don't know how to, nor have the resources. It's, you know, it's challenging to be able to do that for one person, for I don't care what company you are. So I think by collaborating and bringing them all together, it's sort of they all rise together. And I think what we've been able to do, if someone's looking for a candle holder or, you know, a desk, all of a sudden they see someone else's work. So it's fantastic.
A collective commingling.
Yeah. And, you know, it encourages people to explore other mediums and avenues and techniques as well. So I think for all of the artists, it's very beneficial. And we take it very seriously.
Bespoke Global's founders there, Gwen Carlton and Pippa McArdle, they were talking to Hugo McDonald for this week's Section D. Elsewhere on the show this week, we'll have a few extra reports from Salone del Mobile, and we'll be talking 3D printing in New York too. All of that from tonight, 1900 hours London time.
And you are listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a roundup of the news in Hungary.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban. And now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week shows for an hour of essential listening.
A fair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. The time is 8:42 here in London. It is 9:42 in Budapest, which is where we're going to head now to round up some of the stories making the headlines in Hungary.
Indeed, our correspondent there and, well, friend, Adam Labor. He's our man on the ground, and he's on the line too with the topics that he wants to talk about today. Adam, welcome back to Midori House. There's a rather concerning headline saying the Council of Europe is turning up the heat on Hungary. What's going on?
Yes, this is very interesting. There's been a lot of concern for a while about the way that the Hungarian government keeps changing the constitution here. They brought in a new constitution in 2010, which was supposed to be written in stone, and it's been amended for the fourth time now. And the critics say that what the government's doing is using the constitution for party political purposes, which the government, of course, denies. But the Council of Europe now has voted to recommend that Hungary be put under a kind of supervisory procedure. And that will have to be voted on in June at the Council of Europe, which is not the same as the European Parliament. The Council of Europe also has Russia and Turkey in there. And that if they vote for that in June, though, it will be very significant, because it will be the first time ever that an EU member state has been put under this supervisory procedure.
Well, the Hungarian government issued a statement following the publication of this report. They said that the committee member supported the motion in a vote of 21 to just 20, so an extremely close vote. Go behind and tell us a bit of the politics behind this vote and why Hungary seems to think that there are indeed these underlying or political factors, perhaps.
Well, the Hungarians say that Viviane Reding, in particular, who's a European Union commissioner, has got a kind of personal vendetta against them, and this is all being driven by her, which, of course, she denies. But what we're in a kind of very new and interesting situation here, because it's it's clear that some of the things the Hungarian government are doing, I mean, they say they have a mandate for them. You know, they can have a new constitution. They can change it as often as they want because they've been elected in a free election. But it's not really fitting in with what's accepted as the usual norms of behavior of European Union member states. And there aren't really many mechanisms for dealing with that. There's something called Article 7, which is Article 7 of the European Union Treaty, which allows you to suspend an EU member's voting rights, which means you're suspended from the EU. But that's never happened. I mean, it hasn't happened in Greece. It hasn't happened in Austria. It's what they call the nuclear option. And the Hungarians know this very well, that there aren't really sort of lower to mid-level mechanisms for bringing them under control. So they're just doing what they want. And they say, hey, we want an election. We got a two-thirds majority. We can do whatever we want.
In the metaphor of Europe as a classroom full of children, Hungary is sort of misbehaving and being sort of chastised somewhat by the teacher here. Is this a little bit embarrassing for the leadership and for ordinary Hungarians too?
I think a lot of ordinary Hungarians just think that they're being picked on by the EU. You know, there's definitely not the sense that if you join the European Union, there are certain rules, and the European Union gives you lots of money. And if you want that money, you have to stick to the rules. So people here talk a lot about national sovereignty and independence, which is fine. But, you know, you surrender some of that when you join any supranational organization like the European Union. So you can't be in the EU and say, yeah, we'll have all the money, but don't impinge on our sovereignty. Because the whole point of the EU is that you lose some of your sovereignty.
And Adam, moving on to another story. Next weekend, the World Jewish Congress is going to be held in Budapest. Tell me a bit about this.
Well, the World Jewish Congress is, or says it is, because some people say it isn't, the main global representative body for world Jewry. And it's coming to hold its Congress in Budapest for various reasons. I mean, there's been a lot of stories here about rise in anti-Semitism, which unfortunately is true. Only on the weekend, the head of the Raoul Wallenberg Memorial Committee was beaten up and had his nose broken at a football match because he asked someone to stop saying Sieg Heil. So this is really the kind of the worst possible start for the week. But the Congress will meet here and they want to talk about the positive side of things as well, the revival of Jewish life in Hungary. I mean, Hungary has the third largest Jewish community on mainland Europe after Paris and Berlin. And the interesting thing is that it's the only one really where the majority of people were actually born in the country, because many of the Jews in Berlin are from Russia and many of those in Russia in Paris are from North Africa. So it's the kind of the last big native Jewish community in Europe.
Given these two sort of opposing Jewish stories going on in Hungary at the moment, this Congress on one end and then this rather nasty attack on the other, what's been the reaction to this really quite unpleasant anti-Semitic attack at the weekend?
Well, the government immediately condemned it very strongly. I mean, it's hugely embarrassing for them. I mean, and I have to say that these kind of physical attacks are quite rare here. I mean, compared to, example, for Paris, if the statistics on physical anti-Semitic attacks are much higher there than they are in Budapest. But there is an undercurrent here in society of anti-Semitism. It's usually expressed in remarks more kind of verbal than violent, thankfully. So this kind of thing is rare. But, you know, that having said that, after verbal attacks, violence is the next step. But the government has condemned it very strongly, that's for sure.
And very briefly, Adam, moving on to something a bit more pleasant, the Hay Literary Festival is going to be holding its first festival in Budapest.
Yes, they did it last year, actually, in a smaller way, and now they're doing it, having another one this year, next month, much bigger, the Hay Literary Festival. I mean, Hungary has a great cultural and literary tradition, and there's a feeling that Budapest, with its very, very active cultural and literary life, is a great place for the Hay Literary Festival to have its first kind of satellite festival. And we're getting some various big wigs and famous writers coming to see us. Nicole Krauss is coming from America, and a very famous Hungarian-born British poet called George Sirtes is coming over for it. And there's, of course, some local writers as well that are going to be featured. So we're all looking forward to that.
Excellent stuff, Adam. That's Adam Labor in Hungary. Many thanks for bringing us up to speed.
Monocle's own David Pleasant is prepping himself enthusiastically, I would say, through the glass for this morning's run through the papers.
That sounds quite odd.
I don't know how someone preps themselves enthusiastically. He's just sitting reading some papers, essentially. I don't know where I got that from. That's going to be in a few minutes' time. But before that, we're going to get some Italian music. This is Fitness Forever and Distat. Fitness Forever there with D'Estate.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Now it's time for a ruffle through this morning's Italian front pages.
Always a ruffle. You always want to ruffle through them. I don't even know what that means,
you like
really.
Flick. You like that word flick, but flick. I'm more of a ruffle.
We'll look through them. Why can't we just say that?
It sounds more pleasant.
Okay.
Anyways, we're joined by Monocle researcher David Pleasant, our resident Italian, and he's brought in some of the Italian papers. Hello, David. Thanks for coming in.
Hello, Phil. Hello, Dom.
Hello. You've got, I guess we're going to be leading off with Letta, the new Prime Minister of Italy.
Exactly, and it's all smiles and handshakes on the front of a lot of the papers this morning. La Repubblica is leading with Letta's first announcement in government. He's going to stop municipal taxation, the hated IMU, it's called in Italian. That's basically council tax. There's going to be a temporary reprieve. Well, they haven't announced for how long, but there's no longer going to be any municipal taxation. Obviously, that's a very popular move. And Alfano, the Berlusconi's man, the PDL, Popolo della Libertà's man within Letta's cabinet, he said, this is music to my ears. So it's a pretty good start for Letta in terms...
Well, interesting times, isn't it? In that, given how much focus both in domestically and around the world has been on this transition, the first policy is a very big deal, isn't it? And so generally thumbs up, you're saying, for
it
this.
It seems to be a kind of pro-growth policy from Letta. He's already announced that he's very much against the austerity drive. So this is, you know, cutting on taxation is obviously pro-growth. He's also announced no more increases on IVA VAT. That was also seen as very unpopular move by Monti, the caretaker government that he led. They were suggesting increasing VAT, which is already incredibly high in Italy. So two really popular announcements from Letta.
It's a definite marked departure from the caretaker Prime Minister Mario Monti, his predecessor, who was enacting tough budget measures, you know, tough austerity measures, really trying to reel in some of that cumbersome debt that Italy was facing. Now, although he is, you know, trying to reverse some of those measures, spur on growth, it's not really addressing the key problem, though, which is how do you solve Italy's debt problem?
Well, I think in a way he is. I think there's a new argument going on, and it's too soon to see what Letta's actually, you know, going to be doing long term. But I think that there's a new debate going on. Austerity seems to be outdated and, you know, almost backward looking, and depending on where you're coming from in Europe. But I think Letta is voicing something of that growth argument. If you go on, he's also announced the new guarantee for young people, whereby you will have a job within 4 months. So I think it's very much about growth, and getting rid of Italy's debts is recognised, you know, growth is recognised as a big part of that. You cannot just keep on paying more and more off without getting any growth. The country's been stagnant for about 15 years. So I think there's a shift happening.
Interesting. And let's look forward to the future for Fiat now. Some words about the outlook for the company.
Yeah, Marchione has the Canadian Italian head, Sergio Marchione, the Canadian Italian head of Fiat, has announced last night in Detroit, the kind of joint Fiat headquarters. Obviously, Fiat is virtually merged with Chrysler. Mm. He has announced the company's objectives for 2013. And central to that is further merger. They will become one company, he announced. So the kind of tying the strings of that merger that was imposed by the US government some years ago as a condition for bailing out Chrysler. Further announcements looking back throughout the year, losses in Europe are down slightly and profits are up in the rest of the world. So he's saying that the outlook is rosy for Fiat. With the new company, he's suggesting will be that this will be listed on the U.S. stock market. So a change. He wants to abandon the Milan Bourse in favor of the New York stock market. So a good news, kind of good news story from Fiat.
It is quite interesting because Fiat owns about 59% of Chrysler. And if you take, I think, Chrysler out of the equation, Fiat's losses would be dramatically more. So they really are relying on that American output from the American brand of Chrysler to really help prop up Fiat, aren't they? Is there a sense that they'll be relying even more heavily or investing even more in Chrysler to try to pump up even more output from the American side?
Well, I think they're seeing, certainly Fiat is seeing Chrysler as an opportunity. I wouldn't say that all their profits are dependent on Chrysler. Certainly Fiat's sales within South America and other markets are considerable and actually propping up the company as a whole. Chrysler was really struggling until fairly recently. But yeah, you're right. Things like the relaunch of Alfa Romeo to the North American market, that's happening through Chrysler dealerships. So certainly a strong connection there.
Let's just talk very briefly about the last topic. No newspaper review in Italy would be complete without we've had Fiat. Let's talk about yachts.
Yeah, yachts. Listeners might remember that last year there was a clampdown on yachts. The taxation on the super rich in Italy has kind of got very high, and so yachts became a big target of that. And it's been discovered that Riccardo Bossi, the son of Lega Nord's Umberto Bossi, has been stashing away a 3 million euro yacht off the coast of Tunisia, the financial police have found.
Tut, tut, Riccardo Bossi. Riccardo Bossi's son, I should say.
Yeah, his son. I don't know how much Umberto Bossi has to do with it.
Indeed, we're not speculating. That's all we have time for today. Thanks very much, David. Thanks also to our producer, Marcus Hippie, and Aled John, too. After the news, it's the entrepreneurs. Sophie Grove will be here for that.
And I'll be back with Dom for more Midori House tomorrow at the same time. Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.